Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom, where we examine the art and science of games. Fortunately, James couldn't be with us this time, but this is our first official recording for 2017. By the time you find folks are listening to it, it will probably be either the mid to the end of January. But we have a great cast for you tonight. We're going to be talking about a few topics, including the Nintendo Switch, and what are our thoughts on it. But let me introduce you to our guest. This is First Timer. He is a journalist at Nintendo Wire. Please welcome Logan Plant.
Thank you for having me on tonight. I'm glad to usher in the new year here at Game Wisdom.
Yep. It's great to have you on, Logan. We've been talking, I think, just early December, we started discussing things on Twitter. I know December is the holiday time, so that's pushed everything back at least 3 or 4 weeks.
Yeah, that's right. I'm glad that I could make it on here.
Awesome. How was your New Year's?
It was great. I was home after my first semester of college, so it was a relaxing time after a few months of hard work.
Cool. I know for me, 2017 will probably be a lot busier as I've been trying to build up the YouTube channel, Game Wisdom, and I hopefully have some presentations I'm going to be trying to do throughout the year. So this is sort of the calm before the storm before hopefully all that stuff starts working.
That's right.
All right. So since this is your first time on the cast, Logan, for people listening, could you talk a little bit about yourself and kind of your background when it comes to the video game industry or writing about it?
All right. So my history with gaming can go all the way back to right after I was born. I was born in 1998. That's the same year that The Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time first came out on the Nintendo 64. And I obviously don't remember this, but my parents will say that I sat in my mom's lap while watching my dad play through one of the greatest games now of all time. And so from the very beginning of my life, I've never remembered a time without games, especially without Nintendo. Nintendo's the core company, the core games that have always been a part of my gaming experience. So I've just always played them for years. And then last March, I saw an opening for new writers at a website called NintendoEnquirer.com. Mm-hmm. And I had just turned 18 a month ago. They said you had to be over 18 to apply. So I said, why not? I'll go for it. And I ended up getting one of the positions. So I've been writing there for about a year now. Eventually it was renamed Nintendo Wire. But it's a lot of fun getting to cover Nintendo news and games.
Yeah. And for me, Basically, my very first game was Super Mario Brothers back in, I was born in 85, but I didn't start playing until 1988. So I've been pretty much first memories, probably stuff I've even forgotten before that have been Nintendo related. And it has certainly been a long, strange trip from those days. So, obviously, you are a fan of Nintendo, and it is interesting, again, about looking at how Nintendo has really changed and evolved, especially over the last decade, with the introduction of course, the Wii, the Wii U, and what one of our main topics will be tonight, Nintendo's Switch announcement, which hopefully by the time this cast goes up, there may be more information out about it, but we shall see. So I guess my first question then for you, Logan, is as a longtime fan of Nintendo, how do you feel about sort of Nintendo's shift over the last, I guess we can say about 17 years or so?
Well, I think that they're heading in the right direction. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the Wii was a huge success trying to cater to the more casual market, whereas Xbox 360 and PS3 catered to the hardcore side of things. Mm-hmm. And then with the Wii U, they tried to keep it casual, but still tap into the hardcore market with the whole single gamepad experience. And that was clearly a misstep. And I think with the Switch now coming up later, hopefully it will release this March like it's supposed to. Mm-hmm. This is what the Wii U should have been from the beginning. The two-screen experience. But with the Wii U, it just didn't make sense because you could only go about 20 feet away from the console with your second screen before you'd get the little gray message that said yes. Connection was lost. And so here with the Switch, it's almost like a second chance. And with the marketing, with everything we've seen so far with the Switch, it's clear that Nintendo is saying this is different than the Wii U. Mm-hmm. We saw with the Wii and Wii U, the colors were white, black, and then an accent color was blue. Now, with all their marketing, we've seen them switch to red and white, which is also kind of a callback to the days of the NES almost. Mm-hmm. And so it's clear that Nintendo knows that they need to do something different if they want to get any attention towards their new console. And I think so far, they are doing a great job in marketing the Switch. They have a presentation coming up a few days from when we're recording this. It probably mm-hmm. will have happened from when this goes up. And hopefully they continue to market this thing as a clear new console, mm-hmm. since it was a huge struggle with the Wii U to make people realize it wasn't just an add-on to the Wii. And with mm-hmm. the Switch, it's clear so far that it's new, and they need to keep pushing that message.
Yeah, and I agree with you there, Logan, about that. Nintendo, especially over like the last like 8 or 9 years, like right around the time of the Wii, Wii U era, they have been having that struggle with, again, their messaging and their branding. And when we look at the other consoles, especially when we compare things to the Xbox One and PS4, both of them have basically been remaining neck and neck in terms of what their options are, what their availability is. And Nintendo has been pretty much since its inception, been the company and the platform for those games you really can't get anywhere else. There's always been those criticisms of Nintendo, the quote-unquote, you know, they're just milking their franchises. You know, you're always going to see a Mario, a Zelda, a Smash Bros., stuff like that. But what Nintendo does really well, and what has always been their bread and butter, has been their first-party games. The games you literally won't be able to play unless it's on a Nintendo system. And with the Switch, I've said this in a vlog, I think, like, 2 months ago, like right around the announcement, that it sounds like Nintendo's trying to position themselves as either your number two option or the option that you're going to get if you want to play something that no one else is going to have. And from what we're seeing with the Switch, and again, the functionality that they're trying to bring, that they're really aiming, again, to be that platform that's going to do something that no one else is doing.
Yeah, and I kind of thought with the Switch, this might be heading in a different direction, trying to be a more direct competitor. In the teaser trailer that came out in October, our first look at the console, we see Skyrim running. We see NBA 2K running on the Switch, games that are huge on other platforms. But now with all the rumors that have been coming out, it looks like it might not be as powerful as we initially hoped, and it might slip back into that slot as the number two console that everyone picks up if they have an Xbox One or a PS4. There's also a Switch sitting right there. Mm-hmm. And that's fine. Yeah. They don't need to be direct competitors because, let's face it, the PS4 and Xbox One are almost clones. They have a few exclusives each, but functionality, specs-wise, they're almost identical. And it's really refreshing to have not just a third horse in that race, but to have another option either for families or for those exclusive titles. And that's what Nintendo's done the past few generations. Obviously, it didn't work that well with the Wii U. There's a lot of reasons that we could get into. But with the Switch, I think they have another shot at success in being that secondary, as you said. And I think that's a great approach for them, especially given their hesitance to have the specifications top-notch.
Yeah, and with Nintendo games, they've always been about very strong aesthetics. And as, like, for myself, like, I'm definitely an aesthetics guy myself. I mean, I grew up playing the Nintendo era. So my first memories is of the 8-bit, you know, the classic Mario style. And when I see games like Wind Waker or even Mario Galaxy 1 and 2, that stuff wows me as much as when I see something of, like, high fidelity, like, Rise of the Tomb Raider, your Call of Duties, or even something like Soulsborne, with more on the grimmer or more of that kind of like detail style.
Yeah, and personally, there's not that many games that I think are more beautiful than, say, Mario Kart 8. That game is so detailed, and Mario's driving, and his mustache is fluttering in the wind. There's just so many small details, and even though it's cartoony, it looks gorgeous, and Nintendo has always been brilliant at making games look great on their own consoles, which is something that third-party developers have struggled with. Mm-hmm. Third-party games don't look nearly as good on Nintendo consoles as first-party games do. Wind Waker HD is another great example. That game mm-hmm. looks amazing, and Nintendo just knows how to push their own hardware to the absolute max and mm-hmm. puts out games that look just as great as those on much more powerful consoles.
Yeah, and with the Nintendo Switch, as you were just saying, Logan, even though it may not match the PS4 or Xbox One in terms of spec-wise, I think we both pretty much know that, when it comes to those first-party games, I'm sure Nintendo will wow us with whatever the next Zelda is, or whatever the next Mario, or anything along those lines.
Yeah, definitely. We saw about 8 seconds of the new 3D Mario mm-hmm. in that trailer I mentioned earlier, and it already looked great. It looked like 3D World, but kicked up a notch in terms of graphics. And besides mm-hmm. graphics, Nintendo always can fall back on their gameplay because yeah. no one in the world knows how to make a platformer as solid as Nintendo.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I'm glad that you mentioned that, because that is a really good tangent that we always like to discuss here on the cast. I know we've talked about this with previous guests as well, that Nintendo's design, especially when it comes to the platformer genre, has always been amazing. I'm sure as a Nintendo fan, did you pick up Super Mario Maker?
I did, yes.
Yeah, and I love that game. I think that is an amazing tool, especially for teaching someone level design. And the fact that it really isn't as simple as just putting various elements down and lo and behold, you have an amazing level. There is a lot of work that goes into making a level that flows right. I got that little booklet that came with, I think, the first runner, I don't know if they still do it, that like talks about sort of like Nintendo's philosophy or Miyamoto's philosophy when it comes to design. And it is just amazing to like look at that game and just see that kind of thought process trying to emulate it.
Yeah, definitely. You mentioned Mario Maker. It does kind of put Nintendo in a weird spot, though, moving forward, handling 2D Mario. Because do you still develop, say, new Super Mario Brothers Switch and push that out there after just a couple of years ago you put out a game where you have endless possibilities of new Mario levels? That'll be something interesting to see them handle with the Switch. Mm-hmm. And also from a design and user standpoint, Mario Maker is the game the Wii U needed at launch.
Yes.
There was no way to prove this gamepad was a smart idea until Mario Maker. There are a few other examples here and there where it works well, but yeah. That game works nowhere else but the Wii U. And even with the Switch, it doesn't look like you can use the console itself and a TV at the same time. Mm. So unless that touchscreen works really well and they try and port Mario Maker to that, it's almost like Mario Maker might just stay on the Wii U and now it's on the 3DS too. But just a beautiful concept for the Wii U.
Yeah, and I really hope that doesn't become the case there, Logan, because I think that they should really think about, you know, fully putting their weight behind Mario Maker, because again, it is something that is entirely unique to Nintendo, and it's just such a wonderful application, especially, again, for that market of people who are interested in game design, but who either don't have the ability to learn, or they have trouble with, you know, learning Unity or Game Maker or anything like that. And to have something that's so easy to use and accessible, it seems like one of those no-brainers to keep supporting it.
Yeah, that's right. And when I got Mario Maker the day it came out, I sat down and I made a few levels, and immediately I was just brought back to WarioWare Do It Yourself, mm-hmm. which came out on the DS a long time ago now.
Yes.
And that game, I spent so much time developing dozens of games there, and it's just so simple and intuitive, and that's something that I hope can continue. Maybe a Zelda Maker, people would go nuts for a Metroid Maker. There's so many possibilities.
Oh my goodness, yes. There's a lot of people I can just imagine right now just like drooling, thinking about able to create their own 2D Metroid games, especially with the rise of fan games and sort of like those third-party titles we've been seeing. I know over 2016 has been a very interesting year with the fan side of things. I know Nintendo had to unfortunately pull down several fan-related games. Another Metroid 2, several Pokemon games and stuff like that.
Project M was another big one that got taken down. But speaking of Metroid especially, I think that game could be great, especially teaching people how to design games, because Metroid is its own genre of game. You say, what is Metroid? Oh, it's a Metroidvania game. what does that mean? You have to play Metroid to know. And just how those games progress, you can go anywhere if you have the right power-up, but you might get your butt kicked. You might just get destroyed if you run into this room you're not ready for yet. So you have to go somewhere else and find the right ability. And it'd be really interesting to see how people implemented that into their own designs.
Yeah, definitely. And, I mean, hell, Metroidvania, that's easily another hour-long discussion here. That's one that I've been wanting to have a podcast completely dedicated towards the Metroidvania genre, but yet it is definitely a fascinating one to look at, especially what we see is like the differences between the ones that work out well and the ones that aren't as amazing. But again, if we start talking about that, we'll be here till probably midnight between
that's
the two
right,
of us.
Now,
two other major trends or things that we've seen from Nintendo over the years I wanted to get your thoughts on, Logan. The first one would probably be Nintendo's handheld line. Obviously, as a Nintendo fan, I'm sure you followed the evolution from the days of like Game Boy Advance to the DS, 3DS, along those lines. And Nintendo's handheld line has always been, or has been, one of their strongest sellers. And I've always figured that it was kind of like their saving grace, a thing that has kind of kept them out of the same situation that Sega went into during the hardware wars of the late 90s, early 2000s. And with the 3DS especially, it still has proven to be a very popular system. I mean, even though the PSP Vita is technologically superior, it just did not manage to overtake the 3DS.
Yeah, something I think is important in handhelds is making them distinctly different from the console. And the PS Vita tried to be a home console in your pocket. Mm-hmm. And I think that was part of the reason that never really took off, is because if people want to play an Uncharted game, they'll play it on their PS3 or PS4, not on their 5-inch Vita screen. And like you said, Nintendo handhelds have always been their saving grace, but when the 3DS launched in 2011, it looked like handhelds were on the decline, and then after that price cut that September, it took off, and now it has one of the greatest libraries of software, I think, of any system, handhelds or home consoles, and that's what kind of worries me about their recent commitment to mobile, is that these experiences that they're developing on the 3DS, the Pokemons, the Link Between Worlds, Super Mario 3D Land, all those titles are just so fantastic. And moving to mobile, and with the Switch also being somewhat mobile, I worry we'll lose some of those handheld experiences.
Yeah, and that's been a concern of mine too. I know from several of my friends, as we know, Nintendo Switch is basically being designed as a literally a portable console. And if that does decide to take off, what's going to happen to the 3DS or to Nintendo's handheld line? As you just said, the 3DS or the handheld market in general works because it is distinctive from the console line. When you're playing a 3DS game, these are games that you're not going to play anywhere else. Maybe we could stretch things with the Wii U because of the, you know, the touchscreen and the top screen. But in terms of its library, it is a very diverse system, much like the DS. And one of the things that I found very interesting between the DS and the 3DS was how much the RPG genre really took off for it. We saw games like roguelikes, such as Shirin the Wanderer, Etrian Odyssey, Pokemon Mystery Dungeon, and of course they brought over, I think, several of the Dragon Quest or Dragon Warrior games over the last few years as well.
Yeah, and also Bravely Default and Bravely Second are a pair that really took off. And something that's really interesting, being a Nintendo fan almost exclusively, talking to other people dedicated to other consoles, is that if you want to play a Nintendo game, every Nintendo game, you have to drop money for two different devices. And that's something that people just aren't used to. And to me, growing up as a Nintendo fan, that was just always normal. That's the way things are. If I want to play a Link Between Worlds, but I only have a Wii U, I can't. If I want to play Super Mario 3D World only with a 3DS, I can't. And that is a great thing about the Switch, is that this huge RPG genre that's taken off on the handheld system, I think, can still thrive on the Switch just in the undocked portable version, because then it's just like you're playing a handheld. While also the Breath of the Wild, huge expansive adventures can also have a home on the Switch, which is why it's a great concept that really only works for Nintendo, because they're the only company that has these two separate islands of software. And now they're finally bridging those together, and I'm really excited to see how it works out.
Definitely. And keeping along those lines in terms of Nintendo's more like unique qualities to it, I just want to ask you, Logan, what did you think of the whole Toys to Life push with the Amiibo brand?
Oh, this is this is a bad path to go down. I never bought a single Disney Infinity. I never bought a single Skylanders. Before Smash Wii U came out, Melee was my favorite game ever.
I think, and I know where this is going, too.
I was like, I can't. They announced they were doing this Toys to Life line. I was like, I can't do it. I can't get invested in this. Then E3, they show Iwata and Reggie just tapping the Mario on the gamepad, and I was like, well, I'm done. I'm time to spend money on all these. And for the first few months, I was still telling myself I was just going to get some of them. I think that's how we all are. But now I have every Smash one. I did restrain myself after the Smash line kind of wrapped up. Never got into any of the other ones, which I think is true for a lot of people. We've seen some of the sales going down. But I don't care about the functionality. People are saying Amiibo hardly have any functionality in games. You scan them in, you get a one-up, you get something small, you get 50 rupees in Hyrule Warriors, but that doesn't matter, because the opening cinematic of Super Smash Bros. Melee is a child with his Mario trophy, and he slams it down, and he comes to life. And that's what Smash Bros. Is. It's trophies with a kid's imagination playing out fights. And it just works so perfectly to now have all these statues that match the poses of the trophies in the game. It's just, the Smash one just hit me so hard. And I thought it was just so perfect that I couldn't stop myself there. But other than that, it's a little concerning seeing the sales drop. Disney Infinity's done. Skylanders is struggling also, and so I'm not sure what the future is for Toys to Life, but I think if one Toys to Life brand can withstand the decline, it is Amiibo, because they're not tied to one game. They're universal across Wii U, 3DS, and assuming Switch, and they work in all sorts of games, and Nintendo has the most iconic library of characters in the world, so I can see this going for a long time.
And you definitely touch on a lot of the points, and I think your thoughts kind of mirrored mine. I have a whole lot of Amiibo staring at me right now from in my little computer room slash office, and I agree with you, I think, on pretty much every point. And I think I'm also concerned as well. Like you said, they're not tied to one specific game, which is a major pro, but we really haven't seen Nintendo, I think, truly exploit things from a game perspective. As you said, from like a collectability and Nintendo fan standpoint, you know, they're hitting it, you know, 10 out of 10 kind of thing. I mean, I have, you know, Mario, Dr. Mario, I have Meta Knight staring at me right now. And like, as someone growing up with Nintendo games, we didn't have those kind of high-quality collectibles, especially from Nintendo back during, you know, late 80s through to the 90s. If you wanted a collectible toy, it was going to be, you know, a third-party, some kind of licensed thing that may not even look like the characters. So from that quality standpoint, Nintendo is doing things perfectly. But we're still not seeing, like, a functionality, and that's kind of the other half of the coin. And like, as you're saying, right now it does seem to be supported with the Wii U, the 3DS, and I'm kind of curious to see if things will change with the Switch.
Yeah, I think they could. I think we've seen glimpses of great amiibo functionality in games. My go-to example is always Captain Toad. When you scan in the Toad amiibo, which didn't even come out until 5 months after Captain Toad, they updated a patch for the game to add Toad functionality. And what it is, for those of you who don't know, is a little pixel Toad hides in each level, and you have to run around as Toad, and when you see it, you just tap it. And I 100%ed that game when it came out. And then all of a sudden, because I got this little plastic figure, I can go back and revisit every single level with something new to do. And just adding replayability, I think, is what's important.
Yeah.
And you'll always have those who are upset about blocking content behind that paywall. But when it comes after the fact, I think it's brilliant because it makes people revisit those games that might otherwise be one and done playthroughs.
Yeah, and I think that could be a really good point for them to go in the future, is to update these games. And I would say as kind of like the best of both worlds would be to say, if you want the DLC, you can either give us X amount of money through the game, you know, the Wii Virtual Store, stuff like that, or if you have so-and-so amiibo, that unlocks it for you. I think that would be a way for them to sort of calm down the detractors by saying, yes, there is content locked to these amiibos, but it's not locked, you know, forever and ever unless, you know, you either get really lucky at a store or you spend, you know, $50, $60 on eBay, something along those lines.
Yeah, and there's a lot of talk about unified account system for Nintendo and how there's people who have bought A Link to the Past 12 times.
Yes.
You got to buy it on the 3DS now, the Wii U, probably the Switch. You have it on the Wii. You have an original cartridge. You have it through however many other ways. There's a Game Boy Advance version too. But people have paid for this game so many times. Mm-hmm. Imagine where you can buy a Link to the Past Link amiibo, and he works as a normal Link amiibo in every game, in Smash, everything. But then if you scan it in the eShop, it's like, okay, A Link to the Past is yours forever. That tying virtual console games to amiibo, I think, is a brilliant idea that hasn't been tapped into yet. There's been talks about it, but the only problem with that is it would have to be a one-time scan, because then you could just give it to all your friends, but sell it on eBay, but all that.
Yeah, it would be awesome, though, you know, just like everyone passes around the Mario amiibo, and we all get Super Mario Brothers. But yeah, it would have to be, the functionality would have to be updated along those lines. And I'm glad you brought up about that Unify account, because that's always been one of the major criticisms of Nintendo, especially when you compare it to other consoles and, hell, even the PC. As we've seen, the idea of having a Unify account has become a major tool, not just for DRM, but for social and community features as well. I mean, for us PC gamers, Steam has been a revelation in terms of revitalizing and growing the PC side of things. And even when we look on, when we look on XBLA and PSN, being able to have that one account and know, okay, I have everything tied, I only need, you know, five different accounts, I have to remember five different passwords and stuff like that, would be very huge. And I have heard some rumors that Nintendo may be thinking about doing something along those lines with whatever their next iteration of, I think My Nintendo was the last one of those.
Yeah, I was playing a 3DS game online with my sister, and we weren't registered as friends. It was like, are you friends with my Nintendo, my Club Nintendo, or my 3DS account? And it's just a mess right now. And My Nintendo, I thought, was supposed to kind of fix everything, but it's arguably worse than Club Nintendo in almost every way. But I think with the Switch, that's definitely, maybe we'll even hear something about it at the presentation in a couple days here. That's when they'll really get things fixed. I don't know if it'll necessarily mean all the games you've already bought will tie into your account. You might have to buy them all one more time, but I think we'll definitely see something along that line. So there's also been talk of maybe people have wanted maybe a Netflix type deal. You subscribe $10 a month and you have access to all the NES, Super Nintendo, Nintendo 64, just all the classics for a monthly fee.
Yeah, and that'll be definitely interesting, but as you said, Logan, I think that it will have to be sort of like a ripping the bandage moment for, like, when they decide to have that account, and how are we going to tie all these games to it? Because, I mean, I've oh my goodness, I can't even count how many games I've submitted to that My Nintendo, or, no, I'm sorry, Club Nintendo, that was a previous one, before they decided to pull, I think it was like, I want to say 2-3 years ago, but again, time is like out of whack for me. It just seems like I have so much trouble remembering like exact times when it comes to the game industry.
Yeah, Club Nintendo, I think it was about 2 years ago now, and spent so much time doing those surveys to get like 2.5 hours of surveys to get a postcard or whatever that was. But
yeah, I have their I have the Zelda Messenger bag. That was my big name thing that I got.
I always wanted that Luigi's Mansion statue, but it was so many coins, could never get there.
Yeah. Let's see, getting back to Nintendo then, or more in general, one part that I definitely wanted to ask you about, and I think I may kind of know your answer, but I'm still curious about it, is about, as we were just saying, Nintendo's push towards mobile. As we know, over the last year, we have been seeing Nintendo sort of finally look at the mobile market. And again, mobile versus the rest of the industry, that's an easy another 40-minute discussion. But when it comes to Nintendo, they had some of those free-to-start games. There's Pokemon Picross. There's probably several more that I'm forgetting. But of course, very recently, Nintendo released Super Mario Runner, which is essentially their first official mobile game. And I've been hearing debates and discussions on both sides. There are people who really like sort of this more involved game on mobile, but then there are those who are like, this doesn't, you know, gel it well with the rest of the mobile market. So for someone who has been looking at, studying, and talking about Nintendo, what do you think about this push towards the mobile industry?
Well, we can start with Mario Run. It's one of the most divisive things I think Nintendo's done in a while. There's people on the Nintendo Wire team who absolutely love it. They got all the coins in every level. Didn't even think twice about paying the $10. And that's great for them. They got everything out of that experience. And they're still checking in on it every day, getting more toads in their kingdom. But then there's the other side, which I am on, which is I downloaded it. I played through all the levels before the paywall. And I just said, I'd rather play Mario on a console. I have a 3DS. I have New Super Mario Brothers 2 installed. I'd rather just whip that out and play through that instead of this one where Mario's already moving for me. And mobile gaming's never resonated with me. And so it's just two sides. And seeing Nintendo putting out a game which it's way more fleshed out than those other endless runners we see crop up 5 a day on the App Store. But It's just kind of odd, honestly, seeing Nintendo embrace this mobile side after they've said for so many years they weren't going to. And after the $10 paywall also got people a little upset because people aren't used to paying that much for a mobile game. I think it's almost on their next game, the Fire Emblem and the Animal Crossing, two series which I think are perfectly cut out for smartphones. Fire Emblem, you can take out, try a quick 5 or 10 minute mission. If you fail, it'll pop up and say you want to pay $1 to try again. That'll be upsetting, but I think that's the way it'll be going. And Animal Crossing, the perfect smartphone game. You can play that for 1 minute, or you can play that for 2 hours. There's a huge spectrum of how you can spend time in Animal Crossing, and it makes so much sense for a phone. And seeing how they handle pricing on those next two titles, which we should hear more about soon, I think will dictate their mobile future. Because while Mario Run was a great proof of concept for Nintendo on mobile, hey, we know how to build a smartphone game from the ground up. We can put out a successful product. Now it's kind of time to maybe reevaluate the marketing of mobile games, the price points, all that, to try and get maximum revenue. Because I believe there's only 3% of people who have downloaded Mario Run so far have paid the $10. And that is a not great attach rate for something they had so many hopes for. So it'll be interesting to see how that changes their strategy going forward.
Yeah, and I'm with you as well, Logan, about my thoughts on mobile games and mobile design. They've just never have hooked me as someone who grew up with a console and a PC. For me, like, when I play games, it's more of a sit-down experience. Like, I'm going to play this game, and I'm going to sit and play it. Like, I'm not playing games like 1 to 2 minutes on a bus or while I'm out, I basically save all that time for when I'm at home. I'm like, let me load up, let me see, I don't know, I'll load up Rise of the Tomb Raider, which I just did earlier for like an hour, and I'm going to sit through and play that. Or I'm going to sit through and play like a world or several levels in whatever Mario game is out. And again, it's very interesting about trying to, like, Nintendo was trying to appeal to the mobile market or trying to bring their handheld sense of design and sort of try and make that transition. And I think for a lot of people, it's kind of in that, like, in between, like a purgatory between, like, a handheld and your traditional mobile game.
Yeah, definitely. And it's great that they didn't try and just develop a game that had a little digital D-pad where you actually move Mario. That wouldn't have worked, which is why I said that Mario Run was so good for smartphones. Yeah. It's just not everyone enjoys smartphone games. Not all of Nintendo's audience necessarily likes that. Mm-hmm. And so like I said, the people on my team who threw down the $10 immediately got all the coins. I don't even – all the colors, black, purple, whatever it was, just – 100% of that game and loved every second of it. Some people even said it was their game of the year over on Nintendo Wire. Mm-hmm. And that's great, but I don't know if I'd call – I would call Mario Run a success as far as proving that Nintendo can make games for mobile and they can still stay true to like their Nintendo's style of games while also being perfect for the device. But financially, it wasn't necessarily a success. And like I said, it's on the next two games to really prove that this is a platform Nintendo can be successful on that can supplement their Switch and if they continue their 3DS lines.
Mm-hmm. Now, one other thing that I wanted to bring up, and this was sort of going back to the Amiibos, but also tying into the other major thing on Nintendo the last few months, would be the NES Classic Edition. For those of you listening to this cast who didn't hear, this was essentially, I guess the basic way of saying it is a portable Nintendo with an HDMI port that you can plug in and you have access to. I keep forgetting the exact number. Do you know how many games they had in that?
It's 30.
30. Oh, gotcha. So it has 30 games, and, you know, they run the gambit of classic Nintendo games. Of course, you have Zelda, Mario. I think it had one of my favorites, Star Tropics. Was that included?
I believe it is.
Ah, and that was one of my favorites growing up. And what happened, though, like with just about any one of these like very popular Nintendo things, it sold out like negative 3 days from launch. Like, it was gone. You couldn't buy it. And Nintendo ran into a similar issue they had with the first run of the Amiibos, which was, you know, complete product sold out. You could not buy it anywhere. I mean, there was a time where there was pretty much like an Amiibo gray market of people selling them for 3 to 4 times the MSRP. Or MSRP, there you go. And there's been a lot of criticism about Nintendo not properly managing the logistics or not estimating things right in terms of their appeal. And again, as someone who's a big fan of Nintendo, like when you saw these kinds of issues with the NES Classic Edition and even with the first run of the Amiibos, like what do you think about that? And do you think that this is something Nintendo needs to work on going forward?
This is interesting because there are a lot of people who will say, and I'm not sure if I'm one of them. Sometimes I believe it. Sometimes I flip-flop that Nintendo does this on purpose. Mm-hmm. And we can even look back to the launch of the Wii. The Wii flew off shelves. It was unavailable for months. And then whenever it came back in stores, gone again. And it sold over 100 million units. So that's one of the reasons that fed into its success. And then with the Amiibo, on a personal level, I know that I wouldn't have gotten nearly as invested if I could walk into any store and just see all of them on the rack. I remember it was the month after they had just come out, December of 2014. I walked into a store and I saw two Little Macs sitting there and I didn't grab one because that was still when I was fooling myself that I wasn't going to collect every single one of these. Mm-hmm. And later that night, I was like, I got to go back. And so I went running right back to the store, looked, and the Little Macs were gone. And that is the turning point where yes. it's like, well, I'm going after every one of these. These are impossible mm-hmm. to find. And I actually had a great time hunting these down. I think I'm in the minority there for sure. But then once they started becoming more available, I lost some interest. I still mm-hmm. would go into the store, but there'd just be dozens of them there, and I'd grab it and check out and leave. But it just didn't have the same feeling as the first few waves when they were impossible to come by. Mm-hmm. And then with the NES Classic, I don't think it's necessarily that. I think that they did just underestimate demand for mm-hmm. this. There wasn't a big Nintendo holiday release aside from Sun and Moon, which were the fastest selling mm-hmm. Nintendo game, I think, ever. And then the NES Classic was the only other gift people could really turn to as far as Nintendo. And I think that in that case, that is something they need to work on, is for things like that, limited edition. Here's this new console we're releasing with 30 of our classic games from the 80s. That's something that should just be available. That's it cost, mm-hmm. I believe, $60. It's not like an amiibo that costs $12, where it's like, oh, I'm going to run all over to all these stores and hopefully there will be one, because mm-hmm. the NES Classic is a great Christmas gift, and they yeah. could have sold thousands more mm-hmm. if they were just available. And the amiibo, they sold so many. Mm-hmm. But the NES Classic, it doesn't look like there will be huge restocks, and it's not like amiibo where in a month a new wave is coming out mm-hmm. and people go crazy for those. It was a one-time thing that I think they did really drop the ball on, and I hope that more hit shelves in the future, because that's an item that a lot of people want.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And then that actually takes me to, I guess, my final topic for Nintendo-wise before we move on to our second one for the night, and that is backwards compatibility. This has game preservation and backwards compatibility have always been major topics I like to talk about, and we've had discussions about this multiple times on the Perceptive Podcast. And whenever we have those discussions, Nintendo always comes up, because they are one of the few game makers, or one, I think right now probably the only console maker that still has or still seems to support backwards compatibility. And of course, they were really the first one to do the virtual console-wise with Nintendo Wii, and that was translated to the Wii U, and I think now the 3DS as well. But when it comes down to it, as we said, Nintendo has probably one of the best back catalogs of games. I mean, whenever you ask a console fan some of their most memorable games, chances are Earthbound, Final Fantasy VI, and Super Metroid will be listed somewhere along there. But going forward, there's been those discussions about, like, how long can Nintendo keep doing this? And my question for you, again, as a longtime fan of Nintendo, what do you think about backwards compatibility? And do you think there's anything, like, I guess there's any ways for Nintendo to improve or change things going forward?
Well, I've always loved the feature, the original DS and then the DS Lite with the Game Boy Advance mm-hmm. slot on the bottom. And then obviously the Wii can play GameCube and the Wii U mm-hmm. can play Wii. It's just a great feature that makes it so much easier to adopt a new console mm-hmm. when you know that your entire library won't be obsolete, because you can still shove in a Wii disc to your Wii U mm-hmm. and get started right away. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I think the Switch is kind of where that changes. Mm-hmm. They're going back to cartridges, but the cartridges look different than DS and 3DS yeah. cartridges. Mm-hmm. And so I think this is, like you said, ripping off the Band-Aid. We're starting over. We live in a world where you can download an NES game in about a minute. And so yes. It's easy to think that they'll throw on all these games onto the eShop of the future. There's been rumors that GameCube Virtual Console is hitting day mm-hmm. one for the Switch. Mm-hmm. On the Wii U, it was N64 Virtual Console. So it looks like they're about three consoles behind. So on the Switch, mm-hmm. It's the GameCube's turn. And then also, there's rumors of Smash, Splatoon, and Mario Kart. We saw Mario Kart and Splatoon mm-hmm. in the Switch trailer, and now it'll be them remastering the Wii U classics that people didn't necessarily get to play, considering the Wii U hardly sold any units. Mm-hmm. So I think this is, unfortunately, the end of physical backwards compatibility, mm-hmm. and we'll see eventually a huge library online of titles to download and purchase in a perfect mm-hmm. world. we could somehow register that we own the physical copy and get it, but I think that we all know that's not how it's going to be.
Yeah, I'm not, even though I would love to, I don't think Nintendo will like it if I send them pictures of every Nintendo game I've bought in just one very large email. But as we were talking about a few minutes ago with sort of Nintendo, again, like that idea of the unified profile, if there's any time to start pushing that kind of profile, it would probably be at that same time with the Nintendo Switch, and again, moving away from physical backwards compatibility. And if Nintendo does go along those lines, I think that will help them going forward. Because as we both know, I mean, if Nintendo announces tomorrow that they're going to have a SNES Classic Edition coming out, chances are it's going to sell out again like a week or two or a few months before it actually hits.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's something that we all almost expect them to do. Over at Nintendo Wire, we ran an article saying, here's our 30 games for the Super Nintendo Classic. And that's just something we're all hoping to see. And I didn't go searching for an NES Classic. Mm-hmm. I feel like I've played all I really need to play of those NES games. From even Animal Crossing on the GameCube, when you can get all the NES games and play them in your house. But the Super Nintendo has some of the all-time greats, like you said, Earthbound, and then Super Mario World, some of the Final Fantasies. Just amazing console that I know I would definitely want, and I think that would have almost a bigger market than the NES Classic. And that could be a good strategy moving forward. And then in a few years, we'll see the N64 Classic. And it's just a great way to get all these games for honestly a reasonable price. 30 games for $60, $2 a game is great, along with an awesome piece of hardware.
Definitely. And speaking of Earthbound, did they ever get around to porting Mother 3, or is that still going on right now?
Actually, fun that you mentioned that. A couple weeks ago, a rumor came out that Mother 3 will be on the Switch Virtual Console day one, and then the developer of Mother 3 posted a picture on Twitter that they got an official invite to the Switch event taking place on Thursday. So hopefully we know when you're listening to this that Mother 3 will or will not be headed to the Switch, but I really, really hope that it lands there.
All right. I know we are approaching 50 minutes in, and again, I mean, any one of the topics we've talked about, we could probably stretch out for another 20, 30 minutes easily. But before this turns into like an hour and a half, 2 hour cast, I figured let's move on to our next topic. I figure we'll spend maybe 15, 20 minutes or so on it, and then we will wrap things up. That works for you.
Yep, sounds great.
All right, so the other topic we were talking about over on Twitter is kind of the difference in terms of, I guess, expectations or what people are looking at when it comes to the different sides of the game industry. In terms, well, as we all know, when it comes to playing video games and especially looking at them, you have things both from a design point of view and, of course, from a writer slash journalist or consumer point of view. And it's definitely a very interesting topic about how these two sides sometimes differ in terms of what is and what isn't important. And if we aren't careful, this could easily turn into an hour and a half discussion in of itself. For myself, since I've been doing Game Wisdom, I have spoken to a whole lot of developers, and I've become sort of like the middleman between developers and consumers along those lines. So I've had a chance to basically get more involved things from the developer side and hearing some of the challenges and struggles they ran into. But whenever you put your game out onto the market, we have certainly seen cases where games are just blindsided in terms of consumers' expectations or what they like or dislike about it. I mean, I've heard from developers who are like, I put the game out and, you know, they're going to hear complaints that they've never even considered during the entire development. And it's definitely a very challenging topic. And I'm sure for you, Logan, as someone who has been writing about video games, and especially about focusing more on the journalism side, you probably have strong opinions on this as well.
Yeah, definitely. I think that when developing a game, they don't always necessarily take into account the entire consumer experience. One example I'll give is Xenoblade Chronicles X is a game I played on the Wii U. It, when you get into it, it's a fantastic game. But first, you have to get into it. And that's about a 10-hour process. And when evaluating a game, to me, one of the most important things is that beginning, how it draws you in. It's no different than a book or a movie or even a song. You should be hooked by the first few moments of a game. And Xenoblade took so long to get going, just doing all these fetch quests, and they couldn't fight. You don't get your mech until, what, 50 hours in, something like that? And another example is some of the Zelda entries in the past. Twilight Princess, you have to herd sheep for a while. You have to run around the town, throw owls, deliver baby carriages back home before you can get started. And with A Link Between Worlds, that's something they really improved on and noticed. But something to me I think is really important is just that beginning. How long will it take to get going on the adventure? I've watched all the trailers, all the gameplay, read all the articles, and I just want to get there. But first, I have to get through how you're setting me up. It's obviously important to teach how the game works, the controls, the mechanics, the physics, what everything like that. But it's more important to feel immediately invested in the adventure and immersed in the world.
Yeah, and again, this is a topic, just talking about tutorial design, I mean, I've had 30, 40-minute conversations like they're nothing with developers about that. And you are right, Logan, about that first experience is such a critical part about making or breaking a game. For me, it's usually like the first 15 to 20 minutes. If your game isn't hooking me or wowing me within that time, or if there's something that's annoying me about it, chances are I'm going to shelve that game unless it's something that I'm writing for a review or I'm going to talk more about it. But I've had games like that where it doesn't matter if the game is amazing 20 hours down the line if I'm already feeling frustrated 10 minutes in. And this is especially true of the indie market. We have seen so many games coming from indie developers that are unique and amazing and interesting, but they're just very rough at the start, or they're very unwelcoming to new players. I mean, I could just sit here and just start naming games for the next 10 minutes kind of thing. And as you're saying, and especially when it comes to game design, you still need to teach new players. You always have to assume there will be people playing your game that have never touched one of these games before. There will be people who will pick up a Mario game who may have never played a Mario game or a platformer, just as there are people who've picked up Civilization who have never touched a 4X or turn-based strategy game. But making the game appealing to them at the same time without hurting, you know, your regulars, the people who have probably memorized every Mario level or still who have played every Mario game to heart, that is where good game design comes into play.
Yeah, and another thing I think is really important, and as a Nintendo gamer, this is really, I think, their biggest flaw in a lot of their games, is it's almost like sometimes they're afraid to let the player fail. And failure is something that I think should be a part of games, because you fail and you think, how can I approach this better? And then you try it again. But there's in games now, I know it's because a lot of Nintendo games have a really wide spectrum of age of player, but you fail a couple times in a Mario game and you get that block that comes floating in. That's just a little cheat leaf that you can run through invincible. Obviously, that's an option, but I almost feel like it shouldn't be, even for the younger players. And there's other games that Super Mario 3D World, I think, is a perfect example of a game that every single age of gamer can enjoy, because it's easy enough that younger, inexperienced gamers can run through and get to the flag and finish, but it's difficult enough that if you want to find the stamp in every level or find all three green stars, you have to take risks and you have to figure out puzzles. If you hit this switch too early, that door shuts and you can't get back there to get the star, and there's just a lot of more puzzles almost when you go for the collectibles in a game. And there's just some other games that don't necessarily have that, and they're just a cakewalk because they have to cater to younger gamers. But mm-hmm. that doesn't mean there shouldn't be something in there for mm-hmm. older gamers that have been with Nintendo for 20, 30 years.
Yeah, and that's always been like one of the long-standing criticisms I've heard from Nintendo, especially from the detractors, and that is Nintendo has always put the new player, in most cases, first in front of their core and hardcore fans. And as you were just saying, there are plenty of examples of Nintendo games that just really start off slow to the point that they are just presenting this to new players without thinking again about the people who have played every Zelda game, who've played every Mario game, etc. Now, Nintendo, of course, has put in some really amazing optional content. You know, the Star Coins, the bonus worlds, and like, I'll give you an example, like the bonus worlds and like Super Mario 3D World, some like the most challenging stuff I've ran into from a Mario game. I mean, Nintendo, when they want to take the gloves off, in a manner of speaking, they can make some very challenging and well thought out levels. But it always seems like you have to kind of like dig through the coal to get to the gold, or you have to dig through dirt to get to like the diamonds or whatever in these cases.
Yeah, and another example we can talk about from catering to the young, especially, I think, is the Pokemon games. Because mm-hmm. everybody, mm-hmm. every age loves Pokemon. But yeah. the one thing that's bothered me, and after playing Sun, I unfortunately think I'm kind of burnt out and I might be done with the new entries. Mm-hmm. But it's the writing in the Pokemon games is so bland. Mm-hmm. And it was a tiny bit better in Sun, but the writing is just mm-hmm. so basic. Mm-hmm. But then we look at a game that Pokemon pulls so much from is Earthbound, which mm-hmm. came out a long time before. The writing yeah. in that game is brilliant. There's so many pop culture references and mm-hmm. puns and jokes woven in throughout the entire game that
oh, yes.
if you don't understand them, if you're a younger player, that's fine. But mm-hmm. you aren't losing anything mm-hmm. necessary to complete the game from not getting those references, but mm-hmm. if you do understand them, it makes the game that much better. And that's something mm-hmm. that's just Pokemon worlds are vibrant and colorful with all these characters and creatures, but at the end they all say the same thing. Mm-hmm. And it's just something really frustrating from mm-hmm. a narrative standpoint.
Yeah.
Is not having that fleshed out, those fleshed out characters that you're constantly interacting with.
Mm-hmm. And that's one thing that has really stopped me from getting into the Pokemon games as well, by the fact that, again, they are designed first and foremost for the younger audience. And what that means is you really don't get to the good stuff, you're not really tested on the game until who knows how many hours in, or if you start looking at like the multiplayer and the high level play along that line. But I don't want to play a game that's going to take me 30, 40 hours to get to the good stuff. And with the Pokemon franchise, I mean, Pokemon should be one of those series that should be like a no-brainer for me, but I've just really bounced off of it lately. Like, for instance, I'm sure you've heard of the Shin Megami Tensei series, which has very similar, in a sense, in terms of you have like a party of demons, and I just love that series for the fact that it does cater to more the harder core players from the start.
Yeah, and I think another perfect example, very similar game, the Fire Emblem series, mm-hmm. the two most recent entries on 3DS, Awakening and Fates,
yeah.
are brilliant in adjusting to player's skill. There's two different ways they do this. There's difficulty, where there's normal, hard, and lunatic, and then there's the other setting where you can choose if your units die, they're gone forever. This is how Fire Emblem's always been. It puts risk, and yes. you have to decide if you're going to do a hard reset and try again if you lose one of your best units, mm-hmm. and it puts a lot more meaning behind your gameplay. Or there's the mode that can cater to newer players, where it's if they die, they're gone for the mission, but they'll be back. And mm-hmm. that is the one case where it's catering to players who've been in it for a long time, because the default mm-hmm. setting is classic, where mm-hmm. if the unit dies, it's gone. You have to go in and change it to casual. Mm-hmm. And that's just great, because I played Fire Emblem Fates Conquest, a brutal game. I played it on classic, and I remember on the last chapter I lost 8 or 9 of my units, so I don't get to see, you know, what they do after the game ends, and but I had to, because that last chapter is just so brutal, and it just made it all more stressful, sitting there hunched over my 3DS with my heart pounding at the thought of losing these units that I would need later in the game. And it's just such a great mechanic. You can turn it off if you want an easier road, but it's just so much better if you play it the way it was designed.
Now, one other point I want to talk about in terms of difficulty, but before I do that, before I forget again, I forgot to ask you this when we were talking about the mobile side of Nintendo, but I'm curious, Logan, what were your thoughts on the whole Pokemon Go phenomenon that sort of took over for like 3-4 weeks?
Same story with Mario Run for Pokemon Go with me. I downloaded it. I caught a few. I think I caught an Eevee in my living room. I said regular Pokemon's better, and I deleted it. It's just I just have accepted that it's not for me. I just gushed about Fire Emblem for a few minutes, so I'm hoping that that game is an experience I'll want to keep coming back to. But right now, there's nothing that's hooked me in.
Yeah. And now, one last, I guess, Nintendo-related tangent, and then we'll get back to the main topic. One of the things I've always thought of as a longtime Nintendo fan is I would love to see Nintendo create a mature game. Not mature as in, of course, you know, violent, swearing, stuff like that, but a game that caters to the hardcore players first and foremost. And I was thinking about this like maybe at least 10, 15 years ago, and we still haven't seen something along those lines. Because as we've said, Nintendo tries to, you know, hit every age group or as many as they can with their titles. So my question for you, Logan, as a longtime Nintendo fan, do you think we will ever see a hardcore game from Nintendo? You know, something meant for the guys who've been growing up on Nintendo, you know, from day one, you know, super challenging from the get-go?
I'll say no, and I'll say that's okay, because people begged for a dark, hardcore Zelda for years, and then Wind Waker came out, and then people kept begging for this dark Zelda, and we got Twilight Princess, and then it wasn't received that well, when I thought it was a fantastic game. It's one of my favorites. And after that, they kind of turned back. Skyward Sword's the cel-shaded, pretty bright game, and Breath of the Wild looks even more so. But not necessarily just aesthetically, but personality-wise, Zelda games, I think this is the best franchise to address when talking about hardcore titles. Zelda games are, in a sense, hardcore. They're huge, dark adventures about saving the world, but they have bubbly, fun characters that you interact with in these towns. And I think that that's Nintendo's personality as a company bleeding over into their products. And Nintendo's not a hardcore, violent, dark thinking company about games. They want games to be just fun and bright, and that doesn't mean they can't be serious, because Zelda games are very serious, but I don't think we need the hardcore, mature, gritty game that some people think that they want.
All right. Getting back to our topic regarding reviewers or consumers versus developers, another major part, I think, would definitely be the push and pull of multiplayer. And this has been a very often debated topic. I've heard developers speak out about the inclusion of multiplayer in the past, and of course the general thoughts that every game should have multiplayer, or something that's easy to develop, which it certainly is not from speaking to developers over the last few years. But it does lead into one of the challenges, I think, of covering video games, is the fact that so much of the development side is still very mysterious to people who are outside of the game industry. And what we've seen is that most game journalists usually don't or aren't able to build games themselves, in the sense that you would never have the time to write about games while you're trying to build them yourself.
Yeah, and multiplayer is almost a touchy subject. I think of Star Fox Zero is a game that didn't include online multiplayer when it's almost perfectly suited for it. Dogfights in your R-Wings would have been perfect, but it just didn't make it in. But I think reviewing a game, not every game needs multiplayer. There were rumors, I think, a couple years ago that Nintendo's going to start experimenting with multiplayer Zelda. And for games like Triforce Heroes and Four Swords, it works great. But for 3D games like Breath of the Wild, that is a solitary experience that I only want to play on my own. And I think the same can be said for the Metroid franchise. People love the being in solitude in those three Metroid Prime games when you're basically alone the mm-hmm. whole time. And then here comes Federation Force trying to change the franchise. It's a multiplayer co-op game. It did not sit well with people. And so I think it really depends on the game. Obviously, for your first-person shooters, it's required, basically, by this point to have multiplayer because that's what people spend the bulk mm-hmm. of the time in. But it really bounces from genre to genre, mm-hmm. Case by case, if a game does need multiplayer.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And we've seen cases where developers will do something more interesting or different with multiplayer, such as the Soulsborne series, and even games that allow you like leave little messages and stuff along those lines.
Yeah, and there's been some Miiverse functionality mm-hmm. in some of Nintendo's recent outings, and that stuff's fine. Wind Waker sending a message in a bottle across the ocean and some mm-hmm. other player will get it. That stuff's neat, but full-fledged mm-hmm. multiplayer experience isn't always necessary.
Yeah. And now one of the more interesting challenges, especially when it comes to reviewing and designing a game, definitely has to be in what we've seen these days as games as a service, which this is something that we really haven't seen too much out of Nintendo, at least in recent years. Now, with the Wii U, we have seen some downloadable content. I know Smash Brothers was supported for a lot of months after its release with new characters. I know they added like Ryu, Bayonetta, and probably more than I'm forgetting right now. But it has become another very decisive issue when it comes to DLC and post-game support. And this is a topic that, while it has been major concerns on the consoles, it has certainly been a very hot topic when it comes to PC games.
Yeah, what's really hard about evaluating content, length of games, is price points. Mm-hmm. And I think that's all what it usually boils down to is that there's $60 games that will only provide maybe an 8-hour campaign versus this other $60 game, which you can sink hundreds of hours mm-hmm. into grinding, multiplayer, whatever details there are. And when reviewing a game, that's what's really tough, mm-hmm. is that you do have to somehow find a balance where you consider price point. How much did you pay for this game while also not strictly limiting yourself to thinking about the cost when evaluating what's presented in front of you. Mm-hmm. A perfect game is like the Telltale series of games are really short. They provide a lot of story, a lot of narrative, but they aren't long games mm-hmm. versus another game you could spend. I don't think those cost 60 though for the full season. I think they're around 40. Mm-hmm. So if you say a 3DS game like Pokemon's a great example, people spend hundreds of hours yeah. there. And it's people say, I'm not paying $60 for a 8-hour game. But if that 8 hours is enjoyable then and justifiable for maybe production value, story, whatever it is, then I think it's definitely worth putting down the money. And it's just really hard comparing prices to games that are completely different. This is the last thing I'll say before I have to run, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But like Smash Bros., that game came out 2.5 years ago. I still play it about mm-hmm. once a week. That $60 I put down on that is just some of the most value I've gotten out of games. Same with Mario Kart. But then we look at Paper Mario Color Splash. Mm-hmm. I just got that. I played through the whole thing and I really enjoyed it. I almost 100%ed it, but now I'm done with it. And that's yeah. okay. I beat it in about a week and I spent the same amount and Smash Bros. Will last me years longer, yet I don't feel like I got ripped off because I'm already done with a game I spent the same amount on. And that's where things sometimes get fuzzy for people. And it's mm-hmm. it's important to keep it straight that you can't compare price to price, game to game, mm-hmm. because every game is different.
Definitely. And again, that's an easy, who knows how long till we get into. And going back to sort of tying this back into our first talk on Nintendo, that Nintendo games have always been able to retain their value for a lot longer compared to other developers. And when we're talking about the mobile game side, this is kind of like one of those areas where Nintendo clashes with traditional mobile games, which we've talked about in previous casts, the quote-unquote race to the bottom, where we've seen, you know, 99-cent games, free-to-play titles that are very limited in terms of their gameplay, but they're designed to, you know, get you hooked and then, you know, jack up the price there. But when it comes to Nintendo games, the quality and their uniqueness has always allowed them to essentially preserve their price and their value for a lot longer. Other examples would be stuff like the Call of Duty series, or even pretty much any game from Blizzard has always been really strong in terms of their value when it comes to, like, just keeping, like, that $50, $60 price tag.
Yeah, definitely. And Overwatch, that's a great one. $40, and people sunk so much time to that already, versus another $40 game, which you might beat in a couple days, like an Ace Attorney game. It's a one-and-done experience, but that's okay, because they don't need to be directly compared with one another.
Yeah. All right, since you have to get going, I think we will wrap things up again. So many topics we could easily segue into for who knows how long this cast could balloon out to. But we will wrap things up here. So, Logan, it has been a pleasure talking to you tonight, and hopefully we can do this again soon.
Yeah, definitely. It was a good time. Thanks for having me on.
Not a problem. So, for those of you listening, we're going to end things here. As always, if you enjoyed the cast, be sure to, of course, like and subscribe and all that great stuff. Before we go, my usual speech. If you'd like to support Game Wisdom, we have several options available. If you'd like to be a future guest on either a podcast or live show, or even write a guest piece for the site, you can find information and links under Submissions Wanted on the front page. Be sure to follow me on Twitch and Twitter under GW Bicer. You can catch daily streams most nights at 10 Eastern under my Twitch channel. And you'll find daily content, including my Critical Thought vlog series, on the Game Wisdom YouTube channel. Last but not least, if you'd like to support our Patreon campaign, you can find us on there under Game Wisdom. Any donations will be greatly appreciated, and would allow us to keep doing what we're doing, and we can hit some goals. It will mean expanding content for everyone to enjoy. So, again, Logan, thank you so much for coming on. And to end the cast, if you wouldn't, feel free to, I guess, plug your site for people who would like to follow your writing.
All right, well, you can find the site on Twitter at NinWire, or just go to NintendoWire.com. We have a lot of great content. We'll have so much coming out with all the Switch news coming up here in a few days, and we'll definitely be on top of that. And we also have a lot of fun, more personal series. Collector's Corner is a great one where we look at special edition consoles. There's a new YouTube series for that too. So we're all over the place. Twitter, YouTube, and NintendoWire.com. New content every day. And come check us out.
Awesome. All right. So with that said, once again, Logan, thank you for coming on. And for those of you watching, thank you for listening. Hope you have a great rest of the week. And we will talk to you again next time. Have a great night.